Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special episode of the Empire Podcast. Did you know that we're 30 years old next year? I know. We don't look a day over 28, but it is true. Empire Magazine launched in 1989, and because hitting 30 is such a huge milestone, we've decided to launch a full year of celebrations starting this year. Why? Because we can. So you may or may not have heard, but we have put together a list of 30, well, technically 31, as two of them are brothers, of the finest, most adventurous filmmakers plying their trade today. And we're dedicating great big swathes of coverage to them over the next year across the magazine, the podcast, and other media. How exciting. The first filmmaker we're focusing on is one James Cameron, who dominates the new issue of Empire, on sale now in all good and evil newsagents. The second is, well, the subject of this podcast. Taika Waititi has only made 5 films in Empire's, and obviously his, lifetime, but they are belters. Eagle vs. Shark, his low-key 2007 debut. Boy, his wry coming-of-age drama from 2010. What We Do in the Shadows, his hilarious vampire mockumentary from 2014. The magnificent and often mad and moving Hunt for the Wilder People, Empire's film of the year in 2016. And then wasting no time whatsoever, last year's Thor Ragnarok, one of the best and certainly the funniest entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. One thing all those movies have in common is Taika's distinctive voice. The New Zealand filmmaker wrote or contributed helpfully to the screenplay of all 5 films, and so when he came into London last week to speak at BAFTA's Screenwriters Lecture Series 2018, we jumped at the chance to sit down with him in a boardroom at BAFTA and natter about all things scripty. So here is roughly half an hour of me chatting to Taika Waititi about his approach to screenwriting, how that varies across projects like Hunt for the Wilder People and Thor Ragnarok, and why Jemaine Clement is the only person he can write with. Oh, and much, much more, of course, including a pitch for a new Police Academy movie that I am now desperate to see. This was recorded in a boardroom at BAFTA, as I said, and so the sound quality is a little hissy at times. But hopefully tolerably so. Enjoy. Okay, so I will give you a big introduction, and away we will go.
Chris, why don't you introduce me? No one knows who I am. Let's start and go.
I just feel I have to introduce people.
You have to. That's what I'm giving you the cue.
You might not know who you are.
I don't. I need a reminder every now and then.
We are delighted to be joined in this very special Empire 30th Anniversary podcast.
30.
And now we have to give you commission every time we use that, because that is now our new theme music. Taika Waititi, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks. Good. I'm here in London.
Yep.
That's it. That's all I've got to report so far.
Thanks very much indeed for coming in. Yeah. It's been great.
Pleasure.
It's fantastic. So you are here to deliver a screenwriting lecture to listen to one?
I got tricked.
How's it going to work?
I got tricked into doing this. They offered me a free flight and I will do anything. I don't even care what it is. I'll say yes. And then I realize, oh, it's a lecture. And I don't know do I know enough about screenwriting to be able to fill in. Then they said, oh, it's probably, between an hour and a half, 90 minutes. I can probably divulge all of my knowledge in 10?
10. Well, we've got 10. Half an hour here, so...
We've got half an hour. We'll be talking about other stuff.
We can do a staring contest, because that always works on a podcast.
That always works in these audio things, staring contests.
Also because I'm pretty confident I'd remain unbeaten at the end of it. But anyway, let's not put it to the test.
I started before I sat down. You haven't even noticed.
You were blinked. Outside the room staring, but technically speaking... That doesn't
I had
work.
a special surgery in Hollywood to stop your eyes from blinking.
So I'll start with a little trip down memory lane for you. So Empire is 30 years old, technically speaking, next year.
Mm-hmm.
But we're starting our 30th anniversary this year
I'm still technically 28. But
you're still technically 28.
Officially, according to the man, I'm 43.
Let's take you back to 1989. Where were you? What were you doing? What was young Taika doing back then?
1989.
The spring of 1989.
You know what? 89. How old was I? 14? 13 or 14? I'm not asking you. I'm asking myself.
Well, yeah. If you're 43, then 13,
75 I was born.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
You do the math.
I can't.
But, I was around 13, 14, probably in my first year of high school, I think.
Okay.
And loved it. I was very popular. What you want to hear is how much I was bullied. I wasn't bullied.
Okay.
I was extremely popular.
Yeah.
No, I found the first year I was really trying to find myself, but it wasn't my favorite. I didn't really love high school until about halfway through.
What changed?
But what changed is like you couldn't do drama until I think 2 or 3 years into high school.
Okay.
As like a you couldn't like elect to do it. You'd have like once every couple of weeks you might do like some theatre games, or like a sort of shitty theatre sports sort of thing. But I didn't really. Yeah, that's when I think I found I was always doing art. I was doing art and music, and those were my two favourite things. And then got into drama around what we called fifth form. I don't know what you'd call it here. Year 28, whatever it is.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
And so we had, that's what we did. We started drama, and that's when I found a lot of my lifelong friends, and and just felt like it was just something that I loved the idea of telling stories and playing characters and making stuff up. And I felt like, oh wow, this is like I thought they told you weren't allowed to do that anymore when you got to high school, and there was like this one thing, there was one like throwback to when you're a kid that you got to go in and play games and be silly. And I loved that.
Was there a particular spark, a particular film, or an actor or director that you wanted to not emulate?
No, I never wanted to be a filmmaker. It was never really an option. Mm. As when people asked what you wanted to be, no one ever said filmmaker. Or dancer, or actor, or even musician. It was usually a deep sea diver for the seaweed industry, or work in the forestry, or work in the restaurant industry. So, I didn't have like massive dreams of doing what I'm doing now. That sort of fell upon me when I was about 28. I've mentioned the number 28 three times now. I'm also developing. Something where the number 28 is a very important number in this project as well.
Interesting.
I'll see by the end of this if you can guess what that project is.
Is it Thor 28?
That's exactly right. How could you possibly have known that?
I don't know.
We're skipping from number 3 straight to 28 because all the other ones in between will be dumb.
I would quite like to see that.
Yeah.
I would quite like to see what you guys would come up with or Hunt for the Wilder People 28 or Boy, 28.
We did have an idea of trying to do Police Academy 10.
Yes.
But only made 7. And we thought, we'll just go straight to 10 because, on the poster you'd say, well, we all know that 7, 8, and 9 are going to be shit. So let's just go straight to 10 because that's a cool number.
It starts with the funeral of Kerry Mahoney.
That's right.
That's it. It's very, very. It's a much more somber affair than you might imagine from a Police Academy movie.
Oh, no, it's not a comedy.
It's really dark.
Still it's like Logan.
So screenwriting didn't really
I was always doing creative writing, and I was always writing stories when I was young. And then when I left high school and we started university, I was writing plays and one-night plays and a lot of this, like comedy things and sketches with my friends. And so I was always writing stuff, but usually for theatre. And then in my late 20s, I guess because film was one of the last things I hadn't tried in the arts, I gave it a go, and I wrote a short film that I actually originally it started off as like a little one act play that I was going to probably play, and it was about three kids outside a pub where I grew up, and originally it was going to be myself and a couple of friends playing those kids, it was just like a small little thing, and maybe I thought it might be part of a bigger play or something, and I thought, okay, well, this is one thing to test out, see if this kind of this tone works and this idea works. And then I gave it to a friend of mine who was a producer. She produced film in New Zealand, and she read it and suggested that I make it into a short, and I just sort of went along with it. And then after that, it did really well, and I got a taste for it, and I made another few shorts, and really sort of fell in love with it kind of by accident, and I haven't looked back. Well, I'm looking back now.
The rest,
as you say, and as everyone says, not just you, is history.
I should stop saying that, don't you think?
The rest is history, and the rest is
or the rest as they
as
say,
they say
is history.
Everyone says it.
Yeah, the rest as they say is history. As
the
they
rest
say.
As everyone always says.
The rest, as you may have heard, is definitely history, but.
Controversial statement, and the rest is history.
I've interviewed a number of screenwriters over the years, as you might imagine, and there seems to be a common theme between a lot of them, that whenever their early forays into screenwriting, they didn't know the rules, they didn't know about three-act structures, they didn't know about things like inciting incidents and, you know, arcs. And sometimes those screenplays were the most successful. Those were the ones that got them noticed. Mm-hmm. And was that the same for you going back to those early days and your early screenplays?
I still don't really know exactly how you're supposed to format stuff when I'm writing. And I'm not sure. Like, I read other people's scripts and certain words will just be capitalized, and I feel it's a really random capitalization of words. I don't know what you call it. I'd call it stage directions, but is that what you call it in a screenplay?
I guess it is. Yeah.
Okay. When I read those, and then I find like a lot of scripts that you read, they're very, very flowery the way they're written, and they're very kind of, they just ramble on and on when they're describing a character or how. And it's also, and I really don't like reading other people's scripts because of this reason, especially in Hollywood, where they'll have a character and they'll be like, "Enter Christine, 28, wise beyond her years, yet still she has this underlying sexiness that you just can't deny." And all they're saying is she's hot.
Yep.
But we're not just going to say she's hot. She's been around and she's done some stuff. She's sassy, as the Americans would say.
Her eyes have a sadness.
yeah, that's all right.
That sort of thing.
I just started off writing how I would write for what we were doing in theatre. Because I don't think I ever have really written for someone else to direct or for anyone, or to really get financing or anything like that. I just really wrote for myself. So most of my scripts, the way they're written, are sort of exactly what you'd see on screen. So this would be really like a roadmap for me.
Okay.
And then I was like, blah, 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 cut to, someone, finding the bag of money. And but instead of all this super descriptive stuff, my directions are very simple and often just almost like I'm trying to edit the final film in the...
Oh, really?
In the script.
Has your style evolved over time? Did you immerse yourself in other screenplays? Did you read people like William Goldman?
No. I don't like reading other people's stuff.
Yeah.
I get sent things from my agents and stuff, and I find it very hard to get through them.
Yeah.
And often the good thing about reading other people's things is it bolsters my confidence in my own writing, and it makes me feel like my ideas are still better and that I should just keep doing those.
Yeah.
And not to, so that my ideas are better, but they are. And
they are.
No, for me they are. I think I just know what I want to make, and it makes me want to write more. It makes me want to, when I read other people's things, I think, wow, this thing got finance? Surely I could do a little bit better, and surely I could get something else made.
You've done throughout your career, certainly on the screen, you've written short films, you've written episodes of TV shows. The Flight of the Conchords is something that springs to mind. You've obviously written features as well. Is there a flow to what you write next? And might you still write short films, for example, now you're in...
I do still write ideas for short films, or I'll start... Or sometimes I will have... I've got a couple of short films that I've written that haven't been made that I might offer to other people, but some of them are so old now that if I reread them, I know they'll be terrible. it's just like a little moment, this little window I think you've got, and you've got to either make the thing then, or you have to be prepared to throw the whole thing out and start again if you read it 7 years later. Uh-huh. I've got one I haven't read probably for over 10 years, which I thought was really good back then, but now I'm like thinking about it, I have a feeling it's not good. I think the idea behind it is actually quite good, but I can tell already. Some of the lines of dialogue are coming back to me now, and it's not good. So I could rewrite that now based on who I am now and what I've learned over the years, over the last 10 years, and it probably would be pretty good.
You should do that immediately after this, or maybe even during this.
I'm doing it now.
You do it now. Get your iPad out. That's the sound of... That's
typing.
You could be in Police Academy, by the way.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, I'm typing my new script.
This is really coming together. I like it.
What was that sound? If anyone can guess what that sound... It was me turning the paper up a little few more.
And then...
twisting it, and then... She was. Remember that at the end of that TV show? What TV
Stephen
show?
Stephen J. Cannell.
Yep.
And it turned, and it hit another pile of paper, and it turned into a C.
Yep, it certainly did. Amazing. Guy created the A-Team.
That's it.
That's him. Do you have a? Did you have a pile of unproduced screenplays? And how do you decide what to make next? At what
I've
point?
Got a pile of unwritten screenplays, which is like the title pages, and about four pages, and then I've gone, God, I wish someone else would do this. I found writing harder now. Writing is a lot harder now. I found it very lonely. It's just gotten lonelier and lonelier. The only person I've ever written with as a writing partner is Jermaine, and that's not lonely, but it takes 7 years to get anything done. So there's that where it's like, oh, okay, well, I'm not lonely, but it's just taking too long. Or I'll just be lonely and get it done faster. But even then, now, I find it really hard to just sit there and try and think up ideas.
Well, but obviously...
I'm not jaded.
No, don't. You shouldn't be at 43.
Don't think that.
You're not ready for the knacker's yard.
No. Oh, no.
Or are you? No, of course you're not. So, Jermaine, the partnership with Jermaine, which is an intermittent partnership, I guess. Where did that come from? And how did you know that this is the person I want to write with? This is the Lennon or McCartney to my McCartney or Lennon?
I think we're like George and Ringo. And there's probably better writers than us.
Oh, they didn't write together.
We met. We should have got together with them. He's probably more like George. I'm probably more like Ringo. But sometimes it swaps. This stuff's pretty ridiculous. But we've written together on doing various things over the years, and we're currently, well, he's up in Toronto. I'm about to go up there to shoot some episodes of the What We Do in the Shadows TV show for FX, who picked it up, and it's a US spinoff.
Yes.
And
very excited.
Yeah. It's great that we got to do that. But him and Paul Sims and a bunch of other writers did all the writing on that, and I didn't do anything on that. It was great.
Did you look at, because you don't like reading stuff, but did you come in and read drafts and go, this is not what I would have done. This is bullshit.
This is bullshit, not what I would have done, but I can see how this TV show is getting made.
Excellent. What was it about Jermaine that clicked for you guys?
We come from similar areas. We grew up in similar situations, and I think just had a very similar sense of humour. We met around the time when comedy was having this like massive resurgence, a sort of I'd like to say renaissance of comedy, even though it's been around for a long time. But it's like, in the early 90s when it was like, people were saying like, oh, it's comedy's the new rock and roll. And all the comedians were wearing like, like walking around, on drugs and like wasted all the time and like leather jackets and like tight leather pants. And like pretending to be rock stars and then getting on stage and just telling jokes. So we kind of came up around that time when people were moving away from the more traditional styles of comedy. So we got away with a lot of stuff, and we got to do things that were very, it was like very anti-comedy and anti-comedy. What do you, how would you say?
Anti-comedy.
Anti-comedy,
yeah.
I've been in America a while, and some of these things rub off on me.
They pronounce things
garage.
Like
do you guys say garage?
No.
No, we say garage.
Yeah, garage.
Or we say house for the car.
It's garage rock, not garage
car room
rock.
Put it in the car room.
Put it in the car bed. Just for the night. Night car. But most of the time, obviously, you write on your own, and you say it is a solitary experience, writing, and the blank page can contain a lot of fears for people. How have you overcome those over the years? Do you have
You just fill up. For me, I just fill up the page.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what I'm writing. I just write and write and write. And usually, for me, it's just dialogue. I'll just get one or two characters, maybe introduce a third or something, and just write conversations and not have any idea where they're going to go.
Okay.
But eventually, just like, it might even be like 10 pages of just talking and free-flowing conversations. That eventually, a chunk of that might contain a seed for a bigger idea, or like you might look at like just a little couplet or like one page of dialogue and think that could kind of go in a sort of weird like gangster movie that I don't know how to do gangster movies, but I'll put that aside and that might be good for something, or like, okay.
Do you play these conversations out vocally?
Sometimes I do, just like hear characters. Most of the characters are just versions of me. They'll sound like me. So it's basically like me talking to myself a lot. Or I came up with an idea for a character who wore Kappa gear all the time, or just wore trek suits all the time, who looked good but didn't have any pockets. Uh-huh. And was always asking people. And they're just asking people if they could hold on to his phone and the cigarettes and stuff, because he was like, he always had to have them in his hands, but he never had pockets to put anything in. I just like the idea of a character with no pockets, because you know what it's like when you got no pockets. It's the worst.
Oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
I don't have any pockets now, so that's my point.
I noticed those.
I discovered them. It's amazing.
I've gone out a couple of times without pocket, or with one pocket that's too shallow. Mm. And you put your phone in, and it's just always falling out. Or you sit down, and it falls out on the concrete, and then you're like, oh man, I'm gonna smash my phone by the end of the night. It just causes more stress. So pockets are very, very valuable.
And
something that I have a lot of respect for.
This jacket is a metaphor for life.
Yeah, and so this idea of this character came about from just writing dialogue for a couple of hours and just trying to come up with ideas. And then this character developed who didn't have any pockets. And he just walked around throughout the whole story. He just constantly asking people to hold on to his stuff. And then, who's got my phone? And like, he's asking all his friends just to hang on to things. And there wouldn't be a movie about a guy with no pockets, but it's a good character to have in a movie about something else.
I'm going to throw one particular scene at you now. This scene was chosen for Empire's classic scene by Mr. Julian Dennison. And he chose a scene from Thor Ragnarok.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he did. He chose the movie he wasn't in. I told him he couldn't pick Hunt for the Wilder People.
Yeah.
He had to pick something else. He went to Thor Ragnarok. He went to the introduction of Korg.
Oh, yeah.
The Korg and Thor scene. Now, I imagine you had a hand in writing that.
I wrote that character.
Yeah.
I wrote all of his stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of the scenes that he was in, I would sort of rewrite just to basically cater to me and what I wanted to say in the scene. And so I had a little bit of sway there because I was directing it, and I was just like, oh, I think this character would do this, because I knew I was playing it.
Yeah.
And then we would just improvise around it. We'd do a version of that when we were shooting, and then we'd improvise around the version of the script. And then we would like just improvise for a long time and just come up with other things that they had no chance of being in the script.
Yeah.
But then eventually... somehow, I have no idea how, but somehow managed to make their way into the movie.
Was that experience obviously a different one for you because you were working within the studio system? Mm. You were working from someone else's script and changing it and adapting it where you could. What was that like for you, and was it at times frustrating, I guess?
Well, the thing I liked about it was I wasn't writing the entire script. Someone else wrote it, and I've always, whenever I've worked like that, I've always felt like someone else's script, or even my scripts in general, are just a stepping off point, and you definitely get a version of the script, mm-hmm. you shoot a version of that, but then you kind of see where else it could go. And so you hear about writers doing this arbitration thing when they want to get credit for writing on a script. And what I found interesting is that dialogue, so they have like a point system. So let's say out of 100 points, character development is 30 points. Setting up the scenes and the world and everything is another 30 points. Dialogue in the system, dialogue is only worth about 5 points. So it's worth nothing. So if you're going to arbitrate and like try and get a credit on a movie, dialogue is worth nothing.
Wow.
And improvised dialogue, and let's face it, improvising is not... it's not actually coming out of nowhere. Most of the time, people have thought about this and gone, okay, if I was to do an improv take, I'm definitely going to try this angle, and see how this kind of comes out.
Yeah.
And so that is worth basically zero.
Wow.
So you can't get any, because it's not officially writing.
So the stuff people remember in quotes.
Yeah, so all the stuff that you would come up with on the day, even though it can really change the tone or make the character or even actually change the storyline sometimes, it's not worth any of that stuff. But it is also my favorite way to work, because I actually do consider it writing. I do consider improvising and dialogue and all of those things, and the way people describe things and the way things that people say, and even if it doesn't carry the story on, I think it's still tonally it creates the movie. So I consider that to be part of my writing process, is just improvising and coming up with things on the day.
Has that always been the case, right back from Eagle versus Shark?
Yeah. Eagle versus Shark, interestingly, we didn't do a lot of improvising because we had hardly any time, and we were basically scrambling to get out to make our day. And so only every now and then I'd just suggest things to Jermaine or Lauren, or you know, or they would suggest things to me and say, okay, well, we've got 5 minutes, we've got to do it. Just have a go at it. And, yeah, but we didn't. It wasn't like a lot of the those Hollywood comedies where they will spend an entire day on one scene improvising and like coming up with puns and, you know, plays on words. And basically, I call it like list comedy. Like a scene, and then they just go to, and then, and it's always, I will always reference, you know, popular culture references and things like that, you know, like, and you can always tell when you see American comedies, yeah, like someone will say something, and then the other guy will go, okay, Mel Gibson from Mad Max, let me tell you something, you know, and it's like, that's like a classic, that's a classic, yeah. You see, like, they love doing that over there, yeah, like, okay, Madonna. Okay, Madonna from the Vogue video.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know
why don't
exactly
you just
mean.
Cool your jets?
Hunt for the Wilder People was Empire's film of the year. The year it came out, obviously, any other year would have been weird. And that was a film that you wrote over a period of years. And obviously, given that it's an adaptation, was that again a difficult process for you and a different process for you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wrote the first draft of Hunt for the Wilder People in maybe 2005, mm-hmm. and then we shot in 2015, so it was,
and you didn't change a word.
But when I first wrote it, it was not really a comedy. There was not much in there. Yep. It was funny, and again, I think I developed as a filmmaker and a storyteller, even though I'd done a lot of comedy before I started making film. For some reason I thought that you just had to make everything depressing and arty. Well, you still can do that, but it's okay to also add lots of jokes. And so then 10 years later, when I re-looked at the script, yeah, again, it was like a completely different person had written it. But I'm glad that I had left that much time to just to and I wasn't even thinking about it, but I guess in some ways, you know, it's somewhere in the back of your head developing away by itself. And then when you go back to it, you kind of know exactly what needs to be done. And I went back to the script, and I think I wrote pretty much the shooting draft only in about 2 months after coming back to the script and just knowing, oh, this is the kind of story I want to tell. And I completely changed it and added all these different characters and made it more of a fun adventure, which still has, you know, has heart and has some deeper themes. But I realized what I wanted to make, and you know, and I wanted to make a film that does not have an F-bomb in it anywhere in it, which is, it's like when I wrote the first draft of the script, if you would ever get your hands on that, which you won't, it's full of them.
Oh really?
Full of cussing, as they would say.
Hunt for the effing Wilder People.
Exactly.
Potty
yes.
mouth.
And in the original, Sam Neill's character dies.
Yes.
He dies in my original script.
Yeah. Now, did you keep him alive because he's Sam Neill, national treasure?
Shot to death by the cops.
Oh, man.
The fuzz.
Those mothers. Did you keep him alive because he's Sam Neill, national treasure, or did you just spare him for other reasons?
I just want to bum people out with this cool movie, and then suddenly it's like, ugh, what? Now he's dead?
But you talked earlier on about how your screenplays, you almost edit the movie in your head before you've even shot it.
Yeah.
And there's a moment in Wilder People where Heck obviously finds his wife dead, and it's so sad. And then we cut to the funeral scene, and it's so funny.
Yeah.
Did you convey that on the page?
I did convey that on page, but I also shot a version of that where there were no jokes. I did, just to back myself up, because I knew if people fell in love with that character enough, and then she died, and then you went to a ridiculous funeral, that people might just give up on the film, and they might just think, you know what, we can't trust that if we fall in love with another character for the next two acts that, you know, you're not going to do the same to us. And there's something you've got to be a little bit respectful sometimes of that. Yeah. And so I did back myself and make the funeral, you know, a version that was just respectful of funerals. But also the funeral in the film is based on a real funeral that I went to, and the speech from the priest. I'm not religious, so I don't know what they're called. What do you call that? Pastor? Priest?
Pastor, priest, father, minister. Yeah, I'm the same.
Minister. Yeah. That's right, it's a minister.
Yeah.
It was basically lifted from this real funeral that I went to.
Oh, my God.
So... Notebook it does out. Happen.
Jot down notes.
It does happen.
It's all there. Taika, it's been a pleasure, as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend. Happy birthday!
Here's to another 30 years. Burst out of a cake. Brilliant. Thanks, man.
See you, pal. Cheers.
That was Taika Waititi on screenwriting, and we are delighted to announce also that he is the second filmmaker we are focusing on in the mag as part of our 30th birthday celebrations. So pick up the next issue of Empire on sale at the end of December. Not the one that's on sale right now, although we strongly urge you to pick that up as well. For more Taika than you can shake a pineapple shirt at. In the meantime, keep them peeled for more special podcasts coming your way. There are going to be tons between now and the end of the year. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Bye.